I'll give you guys Dave F. Go ahead, Dave.
Thank you, Brian. I'm David. I'm an addict. And I want to thank you. And I don't know Jimmy Jam. But thank you for putting this together. And I've heard a lot. I've actually been here from the beginning at 1 o'clock, and I've stayed with it. It's a perfect day to do this. It's rainy and chilly here on the East Coast. So I'm really enjoying it. You know, let me just clear right up front. I never met Jimmy K. I had absolutely nothing to do with the basic text. But I think that my experience in finding NA as it was when I came in may have some lesson for people anywhere, because there are parts of the world right now that are being introduced to NA for the first time. And maybe there's 2, 3, 4, or 5 addicts trying to figure it out. So I'll tell you how I discovered it. I admitted myself to a rehab on January 18 of 1974. That was a Friday. And there was nothing else for me to do. It was absolutely the only thing that I could think of was to call a rehab and to get myself admitted. And that was the closest rehab to my house. Although I had no house. I like to say I showed up at Eagleville dopeless, hopeless, helpless, and homeless. I had no money. I had burned every bridge, family, friends, and I was sick. So, you know, I went in there on a Friday, and Saturday I met a fellow who I knew on the street. I saw him in there, and his name was Jim, and we started talking, and immediately he started to tell me about his brother. He had a brother named Bob. And he said, Bob's been, he's been clean for about 2.5 years. And he's involved in 12-step recovery. And I know you'll meet him. He'll be up here to see me. And, you know, maybe he can help you as well. So Bob started coming up to Eagleville to get his brother Jimmy out to meetings. And Jimmy had told him, unbeknownst to me, that the only way I'll go is if you take Dave. So he would take two of us out. And he started to expose us to 12-step recovery. There were NA meetings on grounds at Eagleville, which is kind of extraordinary. And it's been alluded to earlier, a fellow named Roy had been voted out of an AA clubhouse in the city and ended up traveling to try to find the solution to his addiction. And he ended up in a convention in Northern California in 1969, and he was approached by 2 or 3 fellas, and they had heard a little bit about Roy. He had shared, and they said, well, there's this other thing besides AA. It's called Narcotics Anonymous. It's small. We have some meetings down in Southern California, and I think a few in Northern California. And here's this book. It's called The Little White Book, and they gave Roy 2 or 3 copies of it. And Roy came back east, and he set about trying to find a home for Narcotics Anonymous. And he approached churches, community centers. And again, it's 1969, and I think the word just Narcotics Anonymous was putting people off. So we met with Dr. Ottenberg, who was the medical director at Eagleville. And Dr. Ottenberg was just a brilliant physician who had transitioned that facility from a TB hospital to, at first, an alcoholism treatment center. And then in 1969, so Roy's timing was great, they decided to admit addicts into the same program as alcoholics, which was somewhat revolutionary at the time. And he allowed NA to establish a meeting there on the grounds of Eagleville Hospital. So that started in 1969. And if you know the history, that's rather extraordinary. We have had meetings, and I'm now 3 miles from Eagleville Hospital. That's where I live. We've had meetings in this area since 1969, Narcotics Anonymous meetings. And we just celebrated last spring the 50-year anniversary of the arrival of the Little White Book. But so I go in there on the 18th, and then 2 nights a week, Monday and Wednesday, there are NA meetings on. So that means that on the 21st of January, 1974, I'm sitting in an NA meeting. And as it happens, I wrote to my mother that night. I wanted to, you know, assure her that I was doing okay. It was quite a family tragedy, the fact that I ended up in rehab. And here's what I wrote, quote, had to go to NA. One of the speakers is a guy who works at an outpatient clinic, an ex-drug addict. He was a professional comedian and jazz musician before his addiction. He spoke for a solid hour, and I didn't stop laughing once. So there's my documentary proof that I was in an NA meeting on January 21st of 1974. But the meetings on grounds were not anything like H&I meetings today because there was no supporting structure. There simply weren't enough addicts in the community to have an effective H&I process. So Bob, there were six meetings in the greater Philadelphia region at that time. There were three in Philadelphia proper, and there were three in the suburbs, two in Montgomery County and one in Delaware County. So Bob said, well, I want to expose you to NA in the community. He took us down to a meeting at 13th and Ruskin on a Tuesday night in Northeast Philadelphia. And as I visualize it now, walking down into that basement, it was a candlelit meeting. There were about a dozen addicts sitting around, and I'm pretty certain that every addict in that room, with one or two exceptions, either died clean or is still clean today. So it's an extraordinary event in my life that I was exposed to this level of commitment, level of recovery. But a week before that, my friend Jimmy was able to get out and go to a meeting, and I was not. And when he came back, I said, so tell me what Narcotics Anonymous is like. He said, it's great. He said there was a woman who shared, and she shared that she was shoplifting, but she was much better at it, and she was doing it clean. So that kind of had a certain attraction to me. But my big stumbling block was abstinence. Most of the therapists at Eagleville were sober, if you will, in 12-step recovery in AA. And, you know, they were all about abstinence. And so I was hoping that NA had found another way, an easier, softer path. And I specifically asked Jimmy, I said, where are they at with, like, drinking and smoking pot? And he said, well, I hate to break it to you, but they're abstinent. And I was absolutely crestfallen. That was my last hope of going to what I thought would be a normal life, which would be a social user. But in any event, Bobby, who became my sponsor, really committed himself to getting us exposed to Narcotics Anonymous in the community. And he had started a meeting in Norristown in the spring of 1972. And meetings at that time, of course, were, you know, very thinly populated. It would not be uncommon to have two or three addicts present. But what I learned from these folks was commitment that and service. And when I look at why it is that such a, to me, a high percentage of people who I met and who came into the fellowship at that time have stayed clean, it's because you were pressed into service. There really was no choice to it. If you had basically 10 or 12 people who were populating six meetings in and around Philadelphia, you can be sure that at any given meeting, you were either the chairperson that night, you were the speaker, or you were the coffee person. So you had to be there. There was this a high degree of level of investment. And, you know, that was where I learned the ropes of Narcotics Anonymous. I remember... they asked me to speak. I had about 4 months, and we had to move our meeting within the church because choir was practicing. So I had to share while the choir was practicing on the first floor of the church. And I actually rehearsed my talk. You know, this was the first time I was going to speak at an NA meeting, so I wanted to be sure they knew absolutely every detail about my active drug addiction. And a fellow came up to me after the meeting. And he said, you know, really, thanks for sharing. He said, you may reach a point in your recovery where it's not quite as important to explain exactly when you went from a quarter bag to a half a bag. You know, that other issues start to become more important, being focused more on recovery. There was no literature. The first piece of NA literature would have been 1976, the first IP. The only thing we had was the little white book. At that time, the NA service structure was identical to AA. I was just sitting here. We had some people who were pretty organized, involved in NA at that time, and kept pretty meticulous notes about what we called intergroup, because NA looked identical to AA. And therefore, we called the gathering of the different meetings at the monthly service meeting, it was called intergroup. And by that point, I was out. I spent 6 months in rehab. And when I got out, my home group, I guess in about 1976, had decided that we put together what we called adathons, and they were all-night meetings. They would start at 10 p.m., and we would go until 6 in the morning. And by that point, we had maybe, you know, 100 people in the what we would call the Delaware Valley, the greater Philadelphia area, who were active in NA. And we would come and bring blankets and what have you, and we'd go in there at 10 o'clock, and we spent the whole night there at meetings. And I think we did it twice. And we had heard from a local addict named Jimmy H, who had connections to what was finally, you know, some contact had been made with California. There are numerous references in the minutes from what was then intergroup of letters being sent and phone calls made to California that were not returned. It's nobody's fault. I've come to understand very clearly just how overwhelmed the folks out there were, how understaffed they were, and there wasn't really a lot of organization to it. But they had come up with, I guess in 1976, it was called the NA tree, which is the description of the new service structure, where, you know, intergroup was out, now it was area service committee and regional committees. And Jimmy H was given the task of introducing that to Philadelphia. And keep in mind that in Philadelphia for 3-4 years, there was no contact with California. There was no reason to suspect that they were any more organized or that they had more people in the fellowship than we did right here in Philadelphia. But nonetheless, we were being told that, you know, you guys are doing it wrong. We've reset the service structure of NA, and this is what it's going to look like. So Jimmy's job was to come, and we gave him the first spot at our adathon. So he showed up with the NA tree and described, you know, in sufficient detail what the structure is going to look like from this point forward. And then we opened it up. And I remember, I shot up to the podium, and I was the first to say, basically, F California. We totally rejected it in principle. Now, we came around to finally that was accepted by Philadelphia and all regions. But there was a great deal of resistance to recognizing that power or authority or any kind of direction was coming at us from California. So I think that, you know, it was very rewarding to watch meetings begin to grow, you know, one at a time, and to see that people could come in and find their way in NA and stay clean and get committed to service and experience the fellowship. I mean, the last I looked, and it was just very recently, I think there were over 70,000 meetings in the world. And I'm sitting here with the World Directory, published in 1976, confidential list for NA members only. And I went through and counted, there were 211 meetings in the world. That's in 1976. So I think by you know, counting backward from that, when I came in, there probably were about 100 meetings in the world. But we didn't know it. You know, we were just isolated. There was really no way of knowing whether there were other groups out there or not. I'm glad to see this level of interest in history. I knew very little about NA history. In fact, when my home group in 1994, we were getting ready to celebrate the 1992, we were getting ready to celebrate the 20th anniversary of that home group. And I made a motion. I said, well, I think there's a founder out in the West Coast somewhere. Why don't we fly him in? We'll put him up in a hotel and he'll be our speaker at the anniversary meeting. And that motion carried. None of us knew any better. And here, you know, that was 1992. Jimmy Kay had died in 1985. I mean, we had no clue. And I had no sense of history at that time. I got involved in history in about 1994. I was in a used bookstore in Westchester, a nearby county. And it was an antiquarian used, a five-story building full of antiquarian and used books. And they had a section on addiction and recovery. And I'm thumbing through it, and I found a book called Monkey on My Back. And I opened it up, and I sat on the floor, and I started reading it. And here there was a whole chapter, and I think it was called Wednesday Night at McBurney YMCA or something like that. It was a whole chapter dealing with the New York Fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous. And I looked at the publication date on the book, and it was 1953, as I recall. And it was obviously talking about events which had occurred in 1951 and 1952. So it was a real eye-opener for me. And I was impassioned to find out what was this fellowship that I'm hearing about for the first time all about. So I called World, and I don't know who I spoke to exactly, but they said, well, you're interested in history. There's a guy named Greg P, and he was living at that time in North Carolina. And they gave me his number. And this is all pre-internet, of course. And so I called and became friendly. Many people in here know Greg P, who's now deceased. And we became friends, united in a shared passion for uncovering the history of Narcotics Anonymous. It was not as carefully documented as it is today. But his mind was very open to that fellowship and to really understanding that fellowship and learning as he did not disqualify the New York Fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous at all. So that became my mission over the next probably 10 years. And it brought me into a community of history lovers. And it's been an extraordinarily enlightening journey for me. And it also brought me into a fellowship of addicts from New York at a great time because they were getting ready to publish their book, The History of Narcotics Anonymous in New York, called The Impossible Dream. And it's a fabulous book, very carefully detailed. And the event which served as the launch for that book stands out as one of the great days in my recovery life. It was an all-day event in New York City. And it's a wonderful work. There was, you know, pre-internet, it was a bit of a challenge to get at the kind of source materials that I wanted to get at. But I spent a number of Saturdays at the local library at that time doing research through Reader's Guide to Periodic Literature and Microfiche and finding out everything I could about Danny C, Ray L, and the fellowship in New York City. And, you know, to see that memorialized as it is in the book, The Impossible Dream, and to see it recognized now as a ballad, early adventure, shall we say, of Narcotics Anonymous has been extremely gratifying. You know, I love history. My house is now cluttered, some might say, with books of recovery history. And it's all fascinating to me because whenever I study or explore history, I come away with a deep sense of gratitude. And I think about, you know, what was it like for an addict in 1949, 1950 in New York City to try to find a supportive community, a fellowship of recovering addicts, to try to find acceptance, to try to deal with the resistance to viewing addiction as a disease that can be treated, to try to find a spiritual path. And what was it like in California in 1953, in the late 50s? I've done the tour out there. to see where the first meetings were in LA when I was out there for the World Service Conference, I guess 5 years ago. And, you know, it's very emotional to see that level of commitment. And I enjoy seeing the beneficiaries of that, the older folks who went before me here tonight, today, who've been around so long and have connections to that very early recovery. There is something special, I think. And this was played out in New York City just 10 years again, because the original fellowship disappeared in New York City. And I guess it was kind of rekindled in the very early 80s, 81, 82, 80, I guess thereabouts. But when you look at the people who committed to establishing the fellowship when it was so small, they really have reaped the rewards of that kind of commitment. And we're all the beneficiaries of that. I don't really have a lot more to say. I think that this kind of event is really great to see, because one of the things that's going to come out of this very unusual time that we're going through, and I think, is the emergence of these online meetings and the kinds of opportunities it presents us to get together from around the world, and who, those of us who have a shared interest in hearing the voices that have been around a long time, and hearing the experiences of NA when it was so young. You know, I think there's a real future for this kind of event. And I want to thank you, Brian and Jimmy Jam and everybody who went before me, for allowing me to be a part of it. That's all I have. Thanks.
Hey, thank you for coming out and sharing with us, man. We appreciate you, brother. All right, man. We're moving right along. We're making good time. This next woman is about to share. She is dear to my heart. She is family to me. She is married to my wonderful sponsor. And I say he's wonderful, not because I'm his sponsee, but because he is. And I get a 2-for-1. You know, I asked Rick to sponsor me, and he's married to Kathy. And so I get to spend time with both of them. And Kathy gives me a perspective sometimes that's, you know, it's just perfect. You know, I get to share with both of them. And so I'm excited to introduce her and let her tell her story. And you guys are in for a little treat here. Kathy M., I love you. Floor is yours. I'm going to unmute you.
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay. So I am